It's the Sleep Well, Stay Well podcast. Here we go. With Malia Jacobson as your host.
Hello and welcome to Sleep Well, Stay Well. I'm your host, sleep and health journalist Malia Jacobson. Today's topic is a big one, so I'm going to jump right in. Today we're sorting out what people need to know about the COVID vaccines potentially available very soon. I'm joined today by one of the most influential leaders in biotech, Dr. Jeremy M. Levin. Dr. Levin is the founder, chairman, and CEO of Ovid Therapeutics, a company whose mission is to bring treatment to patients with rare neurological conditions. Dr. Levin is concurrently the chairman of the Biotechnology Innovation Organization. He was voted one of the 25 most influential biotechnology leaders by Fierce Biotech and named one of the top three biotechnology CEOs in 2020 by the Healthcare Technology Report. Let's get him on the line.
I'm joined by Dr. Jeremy Levin, Chairman and CEO of Ovid Therapeutics. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Malia, thank you very much for having me on your show.
I'm really excited to talk to you about some of the news that is currently circulating about the coronavirus vaccine. I think there seems to be a new update every day, but I think so there's a lot to talk about. But then there's a lot of people who are kind of tuning out, who are a little bit disinterested and maybe running into some coronavirus fatigue as well. So people may not be as informed as they maybe could be, sort of by choice. I think people are kind of getting to the point where they're just tired of the news. Have you encountered that at all?
Well, yeah, I sympathize completely. Every day we're bombarded with new news, different news, confusing news at times. And frankly, sorting through it all must be nearly impossible, coupled with which so many people are just tired with the tremendous welter of news that has hit us for the last 2, 3, 4 years. So I understand that. And I get a lot of questions about it. And I try and help where I can.
Right. I think one of the things that's been a little overwhelming about the news about the vaccine is I think we're used to thinking of vaccines just in terms of the flu shot, right? We think of the flu shot, or we think of the vaccinations that our children get when they go in for their annual well-child checkups, Tdap and all of those, whooping cough and all of those things. We don't think of the companies behind the vaccines. We don't think of them in terms of consumer products that are branded with company names like Pfizer and so forth. A lot of the news about the coronavirus vaccine has been attached to pharmaceutical companies' names, and there's different companies producing vaccines. That has added a little bit to the confusion, I think. Can you address that a little bit? I think it just seems like, in addition to news about the vaccine and its effectiveness, there are also a lot of brand names and companies who are producing vaccines. And so we're hearing about all of them instead of just a generic vaccine.
You know, Malia, you're so right. And at the beginning of this year, nobody had heard of a COVID vaccine. Now, the entire industry pivoted between January and March. And by pivoting, I mean it suddenly went from doing hundreds and hundreds of programs discovering new cancer drugs and other things, but not COVID. And then between now and a little shy of 10 months, we've now got over 194 different vaccines being produced. Now, of the 194 different vaccines, the vast majority come from a different company. And to make it a little bit more complex, there are at least 6 different approaches of different kinds of vaccines. But there's good news amongst all of this, is that in actual fact, there are 12 which are now nearing the end of their cycle of being tested. And so the best ones that we know about are the ones who are most furthest along. There are really 2 or 3 of these. And from the perspective of our population here, The good news, the better news, is that the likelihood is that one of these or two of these types of vaccines will be available starting at the end of the year and then more widely next year. So I think that all of the 193 others or 92 others will come along over time. They may be better, but it's highly unlikely that you will ever have to think about the different brands and names. We'll much more be thinking about what kind of vaccine affects what population, which portions of the population should be taking it. Old, young, people with diabetes, people with cancer. All of these different vaccines will likely be available based on the population. But for the moment, the two front runners are that from Pfizer and that from Moderna. And those are likely to be available to us in the relatively short term.
And for those two vaccines that are going to be available in the near future, are those vaccines that would be available to the general public, or are those vaccines that would be reserved for certain populations?
Malia, the issue of who gets this is central to the vaccines. And right. Your question, I think you and I should agree going into this discussion that it would be unethical for the not to have vaccines available for everybody in our nation. Once we state that, then the question is, what are people planning to do? And that's more based on the availability and the amount of vaccines. So what do we know about that? We know that Pfizer and Moderna have committed to somewhere a little bit north of 50 million doses by the end of the year. That's not enough to get to everybody, but it isn't enough to get to, at the first instance, those who are most vulnerable, the elderly, many of the elderly, the very sick, et cetera. And then in addition to that, but most importantly, the frontline workers, the doctors, the nurses, the first responders, these are essential. And all of those essential workers must be covered because it's them who take care of us. Thereafterwards, the production volumes start to go very much higher. There is 1.2 billion doses being produced by Pfizer alone. That doesn't count what, for example, J&J might do, GSK might do, Moderna might do. So we do know that there are going to be well in excess of a billion new vaccine doses produced next year. And as they all ramp up, there's little doubt that it'll get to all sectors of the population. It must do, actually.
Right, thank you. And I want to dig a little deeper into the timetable for the rollout a little bit later in our discussion. But I wanted to talk about your statement that you recently made. You recently joined with other leaders in the biopharmaceutical industry to express concern about negative narratives around the coronavirus vaccine and how they might hurt public health. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Very much so, Malia. As we saw, starting even as early as March of this year, there was an attempt to politicize all of the vaccine development, the new medicine development. There was also an attempt to urge the FDA to really go outside of its normal, really excellent boundaries for developing compounds and vaccines and hasten things in advance of any of electoral events. This was introducing politics into a topic that is purely science and medicine. And by doing so, you introduced the ability to really distort people's feelings, observations, understandings of the vaccine. And I think to go back to your comment earlier on, people not only got tired of vaccines, talking about vaccines, they got worried and confused. Yes. Mm-hmm. And that was wrong. So we felt very strongly, as the more we saw the introduction of political rhetoric into the vaccine story, the more it became essential for us both as individuals, then in myself as a doctor, and then in my role and capacity as one of the people who really devotes their life to this industry, to sit down and to ask the question of the public, are we willing to stand for this? And the answer was no, definitely not. We needed to remove all elements of politics from the dialogue if we could. So we got together the leaders of biotech and we wrote a letter. It was signed by some of the most renowned leaders in biotech, and all of us had a very simple message: take medicine and science and make it the only criteria for developing a vaccine. Ensure that the process is completely transparent and allow the FDA to use its normal rigor, no hurrying it, no speeding it along, and ensure that when we had belief that we had a safe and effective vaccine, that the process was intact and that science and medicine had essentially been the core of that decision. It was incredibly gratifying, Malia. The next week, following our letter, every single CEO of all of the major vaccine companies wrote a public similar letter. And then even more gratifying to see that the FDA, who we hold in such high esteem, actually wrote a series of protocols and published those to ensure that everybody had confidence in their assessment of these vaccines. So the letter we wrote had a cascading effect, and to up to the credit of both the CEOs and the FDA, these are now very public statements, and I believe that people are holding to them.
Thank you so much for going over that. And just to put that in a time context, when did that letter go public?
That letter went public a couple months ago.
And in that letter, you said that you would like companies to gain public trust and set reasonable expectations for the vaccine's safety and effectiveness. Based on what we now know about the vaccine, what are some reasonable expectations for the public?
Gosh, Malia, you know, I was a little surprised by the data that's been published. Now, just to be clear, the data has been published in a press release. It has yet to be fully vetted by the FDA or by peer review. But let us assume, and I think it's reasonable to assume, that the companies are, as I believe they are, completely ethical and are actually putting out real data, then the data that we're seeing exceeds many of my best expectations. The FDA and others who approve, for example, flu vaccine, set a bar for between 40 and 60% effective. And in both Pfizer and Moderna, we're seeing well in excess of 90% effective. What we don't yet know is the full safety profile of those vaccines. However, the first indications that we have are that these vaccines are meeting very stringent safety parameters. So I think one should be led to be very encouraged by this, because a vaccine with that type of efficacy above 90%, and if it shows, as I believe it is likely to do, a very good safety profile, then this is real light at the end of the tunnel. This is not a glimmer. This is a bright light at the end of the tunnel.
Oh my goodness, that's so good to hear. And so, talking again about the timetable, so you mentioned that there's likely to be vaccines available by the end of the year, which is rapidly approaching. So we have that glimmer of hope. And then how long might it be? And again, these are just projections at this point, before everyone in the US who wants a vaccine would be able to get one?
Well, with the caveat that the safety profile continues to be what it is, then I would estimate, based on all of the work that's being done in Warp Speed, that's the program to accelerate manufacturing that's been guided by a very ethical gentleman, a physician by the name of Dr. Monsef Saloui, those projections estimate that literally by the end of March, beginning of April, there'll be a very large rollout. And I would estimate, based on that, we're going to see a substantial proportion of America being having available vaccines sometime by the middle of the year. And that is, I think, might even be a touch conservative. However, we do need to see the data on safety, and we do need to know that there is a smooth handover, and this is very important, Malia, a smooth handover in the transition in government. If there is not, then whatever I've just said could be delayed by months, in order that, for political reasons, again, not just the development of vaccines, but now the distribution of vaccines has been interrupted. It's critical from a medical and perspective that an organized distribution take place. And that can only take place in the context of a completely smooth transition, which should unfortunately have started weeks ago, but has not yet. If it does not start, then I'm afraid my projection is likely to push out.
Right. There's so much going on right now and so much yet to be seen, but thank you for that. So how does our vaccine timetable in the U.S. relate to the global outlook for vaccines? And this is something that's been on my mind as a resident of the Seattle area where the coronavirus first touched down in the U.S. We know that we are such a global society and that we can't look at the U.S. as an isolated population when it comes to vaccination and public health. So how might the global outlook for vaccines impact the way that we approach this issue?
Boy, you live in a wonderful part of the world. Malia, the way that one should think about this is that there have been already attempts to vaccinate people. These are rather unfortunate attempts. For example, Russia has rolled out a vaccine without ever really testing it. We have no idea whether that's working or not. Other countries seem to be doing the same. Portions of India seem to be doing that. China seems to be doing similar. However, I think that I think we should feel encouraged because Pfizer, Moderna, GSK have all committed to allocate vaccines to portions of the world that are frequented by people who come to the United States. They have indeed, in some cases, offered and have already contracted to supply hundreds of millions of doses abroad. So I believe with the power of some of these large global companies, particularly, as I say, GSK, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, and also J&J, I think there's a high likelihood that governments will purchase and act on in a actually possibly even more organized way than we. When I say possibly more organized, it's often easier where you have a single national hospital system, as you do in Great Britain, as you do in many of the European countries, to manage the rollout in an organized and thoughtful fashion, a mass vaccination protocol. And that is likely to happen in those countries. And certainly in Seattle, where you see a huge number of people coming from East Asia, you have at least another advantage. Number one, the frequency of disorder of COVID in many of those nations is way below what you see in Europe today. And their ability, therefore, their ability to adopt effective vaccination programs in Korea, Japan, and across Southeast Asia is extremely high, and they will do it. They will do it very effectively. So I am optimistic. However, there's a little bit of a cloud on that, not 100% of a cloud, and that is we withdrew all support from the organization that was set up to do exactly this, and that was the World Health Organization. In the absence of having an organized distribution around the world, I expect that unless we can get this remotivated, reorganized, then we'll see a disjointed approach to begin with until enough people have been vaccinated so that we can have confidence that everybody coming to the United States has at least been vaccinated. By the way, Malia, don't forget, there used to be a time, probably when most of your listeners don't recall, but there used to be a time when you had to demonstrate that you'd had a yellow fever vaccination before you could travel internationally. Or for that matter, you had to show that you'd had a polio vaccination. This is not something that hasn't been done in the past. I expect us to do it again.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And that leads me to my next question. I think that there has just been sort of, the world has sort of been holding its breath, or at least our country holding its breath for a vaccine so that life can return to quote unquote normal in terms of travel, in terms of our children returning to school. And I think as we have seen, the reality is just so much more complex than that. What is possibly a more realistic view of life returning to what people might deem some version of normal as the vaccine rolls out over the next year or so?
Well, I think the real challenge will be is clear guidance from the national government of the United States. Not second guessing in different states, not implementing different standards or having or knowing about different standards, but rather a clear voice which allows you and me, our neighbors, our friends, our family, to be able to speak to the local school board, to be able to speak to the local enterprise endeavor, to allow us to have the clear understanding of what we need to be doing in a sensible fashion.
Right. So you're referring to clear guidance at the federal level, as opposed to the very disjointed state, county, you know, local communication that we have had around this. As a professional communicator who works in the health field, it has been so interesting to me and yet frustrating to me the quality of public information around this. And part of it is that it is coming from state governments, county health departments, and then something totally different at the federal level. So you're referring to a clear unified set of guidelines at the federal level. Is that right?
Yes, I am. And it's Malia, the way to think about this is that when you are attacked as a nation by an enemy, it's everybody in the same boat. That enemy is the enemy of the nation. And what you need at that moment is clear, unified communication on a federal basis so you can all face the enemy armed with the right information and the right ability to respond to that. This COVID virus is an enemy. It's as simple as that. It has invaded these shores. It swept across the nation. And in the absence of clear, unified communication, everybody's tried to do the best they can. Everybody had a different opinion, but nobody was given a centralized view of what to do. And this was a manifest challenge for everybody. And communicators like yourself play such an important role because it's you who are able to reach people and to teach them. All of there's lots of smart people. Everybody's got a different opinion. But you can only form those opinions if you're given the facts. And so in medicine, it's often that we make decisions out of what our neighbor says, out of what our friends say, of common diseases, diabetes, cancer, diets, etc. But where it comes to something like this, where you have a true enemy, something that's sweeping across you, and you don't have time to really formulate real knowledge that is based on years of experience with your families, for example, in cancer, diabetes, etc. Here you need an acute assembly of all of the pieces of information spoken very clearly and advice given very clearly. The federal government has failed to give this. This is not wise. It's left confusion. It's left fear. And now as we go into that one, that bright light of having vaccines, there's a lot of work to be done just communicating of how to get the families working, how to get the kids to school, and how to stay safe, a lot.
Right, and there has been so much, as you said, confusion and misinformation that now that there is real news and real progress, people are tuning it out. And so there is work to be done in this area, but it is really encouraging to hear about the progress. But yes, it's been just such an interesting and frustrating year from a public health information standpoint to watch everyone scrambling and to see real, true, accurate news and information be censored and limited, and then see so much misinformation spread through social media.
You're saying this very kindly. I don't. Okay, and I'm afraid, I apologize to your listeners. I'm a physician. My whole life is devoted to saving lives. I know that when you give a medicine to a patient, you change their life for always. I've sat at the beds of people who die, who are dying, and talked to them and held their hands. I've watched people get out of beds having been desperately ill and felt the triumph of watching that. What I cannot under any circumstance, feel anything other than complete sorrow that the federal government failed to meet this enemy, period. Let's not kid ourselves. And by politicizing this whole issue, it took out of the hands of America the ability to fight. America's great at fighting things, for heaven's sakes. Pearl Harbor hit us, we won. We went to war after 9/11, a dreadful situation, we won. Here, we're losing. We're losing simply because we're not getting the information we need in a timely fashion. We've lost 250,000 people. That's astonishing. Astonishing. What a shame to us to have done that. And it's going to climb. It's going to get worse before it gets better. And all I can say is that the industry rose to this occasion. I think you and I and our kids and our family and our neighbors are incredibly fortunate that this industry did rise to its occasion. But what we can never forget is the failure to address this frontally right to begin with, because that, if we ever do this again with another pandemic, I think we will have really betrayed what's really truly American, and that's the ability to look after the people of this nation.
Thank you. I could not agree more. Is there anything else that you wanted to add on the topic of the vaccine that we haven't covered yet?
No, except to say I'm super excited. I can change my tone because I am excited. I really salute those companies. They are fantastic. Nobody asked them to do this, by the way. They all jumped in. That's the other thing. And when you think about it, in the beginning of January, there were no programs. For this industry to turn on a dime and to do this is so difficult. It requires so many moving pieces and so much motivation to do it. It's not easy. It's not like assembling a new automobile.
And I did see that as well from my perspective. I essentially interview doctors and researchers for a living, and I saw the entire industry pivot to all resources were dedicated to researching the vaccine and to researching COVID on a dime. Just everything pivoted, and it was remarkable and impressive. And it meant that people sitting in my seat could not get interviews with people that we wanted to talk to, and we couldn't, you know, that it affected the dialogue around public health because you simply couldn't interview someone on another topic. Research that we were following on other topics all of a sudden pivoted, and just everybody had to kind of change their course. But it was amazing to see and to witness. It was very impressive. And now we are seeing the results of that on the other end, or sure starting. And I wanted to kind of pivot to another topic. Your company has developed a treatment for a rare disorder that affects sleep called Angelman syndrome, and that is something that is very, very important for the families affected by this disorder. Up to 80% of the children with this disorder experience very severe sleep disturbances that have just a huge impact on the health and well-being of the family. Can you talk about that a little bit and how that might help families affected by this condition?
Yes, indeed. And thank you for asking. There's actually a terribly significant link with COVID. We all know that COVID affects patients differently. And we all know that people with different disorders are harmed differentially. But I don't think that anybody knows in your audience that what are called developmental disorders, those that you develop in utero and have throughout your life, sometimes autism, sometimes inability to speak, Fragile X, and this disorder, Angelman's, they are the most at risk. They die more frequently than those with lung cancer, spina bifida, leukemia, chronic kidney disease, Alzheimer's, colorectal, the ones with the disorders that we're treating die most frequently. Highest morbidity. So what are these disorders? Angelman's is one that develops in uterus. You can't predict it. It's rare that it's ever inherited. It just develops. And a beautiful child is born. And very quickly, you realize that child is suffering. Over the next 2 years, you watch its developmental milestones slow down. It can't walk. It can't talk. It doesn't hold a bottle. And then it doesn't sleep. The child doesn't sleep. And this sleep disruption is profound. They also have epilepsy, and it was a disorder discovered in 1965 by a man called Harry Angelman, who was given his name, Angelman's. It wasn't until 1987 that we knew its genetic cause, which is the switching off of a particular gene in which causes all of the cells in the brain to start to behave differently. And the result is that you have children who are lovely, they're charming, they have wonderful dispositions. They grow up and they live their entire lives having to be cared for. There are no medicines for it, none. In 2014, we founded Ovid with one objective, and that was the objective to find a medicine that would alleviate their ability to walk, to help them to walk better, help them to sleep better, help them to handle, literally to button their shirt or to feed themselves, to tie their socks, to tie their shoes, pull up their socks if they had socks. All of these things were affected and affected profoundly. And most desperately, as families get them to 18, when they can no longer care for them, the real fear that these kids would now go into long-term care, and how would that long-term care look after their loved kids? So we started the company Ovid, and 6 years later, I'm incredible. Despite COVID, we pushed through COVID. We refused to let us stop our trials. Despite that, with the help of all of the families, we're within weeks of the final step of our clinical trials. It's called a pivotal phase 3 clinical trial. The compound is called OV101. We've tried it. We've had trials already on adults and adolescents, and they have been successful. That was called the STARS trial. Now the trial that's coming due imminently, the data from the trial is called the Neptune trial. And what this medicine, if it is ever approved, will hopefully do, it will help the individuals sleep, definitely. It will help the individual behave in a way that is less stressed, very much more normalized. It will help the child hopefully communicate and certainly help all of their motor effects. Now, we know it does that in animals, and we know it does. We've seen those effects in adults and adolescents. And now this trial is on children between the ages of 2 and 12. And if we are successful, we'll take the results of this trial to the FDA and seek approval such that by the end of next year, the beginning of 2022, the first medicine ever in this field will come about. But Malia, you're a sleep expert. You know lots about sleep. You know what it does. Right.
and you mentioned that the children with affected by this condition do not sleep. And, no. And as you mentioned, with many neurological disorders, there is a very significant sleep disturbance component that is rarely talked about. These families kind of suffer in silence in terms of the sleep disturbance. What does it look like from the sleep standpoint? Are they just sleeping in disrupted kind of periods throughout the day? Do they just need less sleep? Are they not able to attain a deeper stage of sleep that allows them to sleep for longer periods? What is going on?
So this is a profound disorder of sleep. About 80% of the children with Angelman syndrome have some form of very severe sleep disturbance, which generally, and I will go into the details of that, will often require that one parent is awake all night. So some parents actually share the evenings. One sleeps till midnight and then the other one takes over at midnight. The reason is that, and often that might even lead to the next thing, which is they give up work to do this. What happens is that the child does not go to sleep. And then when they are asleep, the sleep is extremely, extremely disrupted. They really found there's been a tremendous reduction in sleep efficiency, a lower percentage of REM sleep, and a higher percentage of slow wave sleep. And then the next day is really totally disrupted. And often when they're sent to school, you'll find the kid napping. And so, because they're asleep. So the entire sleep cycle has been disrupted. One of the things that we do know about OV101 is it's quite unusual. It's the only compound that we know that appears to normalize the sleep cycle. That's in contradistinction to other sleep drugs like the benzodiazepines, where you actually right. have the sleep cycle disrupted. This one doesn't. Yeah.
That is pretty remarkable. And do you know at this point, once a child starts on this medication, how long does it take to normalize their sleep schedule?
Well, we don't know fully because the trials have run for approximately 12 weeks each trial. And then we've had children on this and adults and adolescents for nearly 2 years. So we will assess fully where you get full normalization over the next several years. But we do know that you can continue to take this particular medication. It's a pill that's taken once at night. And if the trial is successful, then we'll be able to follow these children for the years to come and watch how it affects their EEGs. So I'll be able to give you the full information on it. But we do know that in normal people, in people who do not have this genetic defect, they will be able to take this medicine for several years without any disruption. Those were clinical trials done just to simply show, could it affect insomnia? And it does.
Okay, thank you. And you mentioned that that may be available end of 2021, beginning of 2022. I think you might be noticing a theme. I need a timetable.
I need a calendar. So the way this will work is that before the end of the year, we will unveil our data. That is the final step of the data gathering. If that data is positive, we'll announce it certainly before the end of this year. Then we will assemble a package to go to the FDA and seek approval of this as a medicine that we can distribute to all the families. That approval is subject to the FDA, if it should come, would be at the end of next year, where afterwards we would immediately start to distribute. Our goal is to get this to every single child with Angelman's as soon as possible. So that's the timetable that we have at the moment. I would love to be able to speed it up, but I can't guarantee it will be speeded up.
Right. And as we mentioned before, we don't always want to speed those things up. We want the due process to take place.
Exactly. Malia, in this instance, it's interesting you say that. I focused on the safety of these children because nobody had ever run an industrial clinical trial with their help. And nobody knew how new medicines would react on them. So the number one item on this was safety. And we showed that. We've now had lots of individuals on it. We know that there are very few, the safety and tolerability profile is excellent. And the FDA has been incredibly helpful in helping us define how would you find a medicine to help an individual where every single cell in their brain has been affected by this genetic problem. Every single one. Every single behavior, every single way that they live has been affected. How do you find something? You can't just help them to walk a little better, can't just help them to eat a little better. Those are all good, but they're not sufficient. You've really got to bend the curve and change their lives. So hopefully, if we're right this time, then like I said to you, I know that every time you give a medicine to somebody, you change their life. I'm really hoping for that here.
That is exciting. And how can families who are affected by this condition kind of follow along with these developments?
All they need to do is actually sign into our website. And the website is www.ovidrx.com, ovidrx.com. And there's a full flow of information there. In addition to which, the Angelman Syndrome Foundation, ASF Foundation, tracks all of the different companies now developing. Malia, what's really fun here, just as an aside for your listeners, when we started this in 2014, nobody believed you could do this. Nobody did. And as we showed them in 2018 that you could have an effect on adults and adolescents, it was incredibly wonderful to watch at least up to about 10 or 12 other companies jump in and saying, well, we have a different approach. Let's see if we can do this. And now we're about to find out if we have a result. But we know that behind us, a long way behind us, but it is several years behind where we are, there'll be others. So I am really confident now that Angelman's, by showing that you could, showing that you should, and taking the chance to do it, Ovid will have opened up the opportunity for really changing the lives of all of these children with Angelman's. And that's exciting to me. That's what a way to go. That's exactly what we should be doing. And there's a lot of them around the world, 500,000.
Right, that is very exciting. I am really encouraged by this and I look forward to following along and to really hearing some of those personal stories unfold as well. I think that will be really, really interesting and exciting to watch over the next couple of years. Well, thank you for sharing that. And I have to say, it is nice to hear some encouraging news on the health front and to talk about a health condition that is not COVID. it's just kind of refreshing.
Well, you know, but you're right. But it's interesting that I did not know until I met you, when I knew I was going to talk to you, that you knew anything about sleep. And what a pleasure it is for me to have the chance to meet a world expert in sleep, somebody who understands how important it is and how critical it is. It's something we've lived with. And so I'm learning a lot. I read up about what you do.
Oh, well, thank you. Yep, I think it is something that really touches every aspect of our lives. And I'm glad that it is, the topic is getting the attention that it deserves, because boy, it just sure makes a difference in family life when people start being able to get the sleep that they need. So it's exciting to know that is maybe on the horizon for these families who will be affected. Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you again so much for joining me today, Dr. Levin. And your website again is www.ovidrx.com. I'd like to thank my listeners for joining me. That is all for this episode. Until next week, please sleep well and stay well. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
It's the Sleep Well, Stay Well podcast, now you know. Thanks for checking out the show.